originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pravnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barajabort crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I am joining you tonight from our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studio. I would like to thank everyone listening to us tonight on Sirius 219, XM 206, and also to those of you tuning into our website. That's www.horseracingradio.net. A portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries. If you are able to help, please visit their website. That's www.pdjf.org. So our guest this evening was a 6-time leading rider at Delaware Park. Twice, he won 6 races in a single day. He won multiple graded stakes victories, including the Pennsylvania Derby, the Delaware Oaks twice, and the Ohio Derby twice. With 2,907 victories and over $44 million in earnings, it is a pleasure to introduce jockey Michael McCarthy. Michael, welcome to the show.
Hello, Christina and horse racing fans. Thank you for having me.
So great to have you here on the show, Michael. I have not seen you in a very, very long time. You were an agent at Parks when I was riding out east, and actually your son Trevor was on the show just a couple of months ago. That has to be very exciting for you, seeing all of the success your son has had now.
Yeah, it's really great. Yeah, it's really nice that I was able to like help him along and, you know, watch him grow. My wife and I are just so ecstatic over how he's done in such a short period of time.
We'll talk more about his success, but you didn't really have that luxury though. You weren't born into a family of jockeys. So tell us how you first got introduced to the sport.
My father was, he just liked to go to Belmont Park and gamble on the horses. I would tag along, and it was around the time when I was kind of getting into my teens, and I always played sports as a young kid, like, the little league stuff and all that, which I was very good at. But then once, you know, all the kids started growing, I never grew. So I stayed short and light and, you know, just small in stature. And I really loved playing football, but they kept knocking the heck out of me, so to speak, because they kept growing and I, you know, never grew till later on. And so I was getting a bit frustrated. And I was like, oh, my God, you know, I have, you know, all this talent. You know, I could play basketball or football and baseball and stuff, but, you know, now I can't use it anymore. What am I going to do? And I didn't have very good grades in school. I wasn't like a really smart kid that way. Some people are born geniuses. I just wasn't born a genius, unfortunately. And I said, oh my God, what am I going to do? And when my dad took me to the horse races, I don't know, it was instantaneous. I remember like vividly standing on the apron at Belmont Park and watching the horses come to the finish line, you know, as the jockeys are riding them and the whips are going and the horses, you can hear them just rumble past. And it was almost like a light bulb went off over my head and said, oh, my God, this is it. And from that moment on, I just said, this is what I want to do.
You were hooked immediately.
I was hooked.
Well, and you say you were small, so you weren't able to have success in football and basketball. But later on, though, Michael, you did grow. You're actually very, very tall for a jockey. And did that, when you eventually grew, were you concerned that you would be able to pursue?
Ironically said, I mean, I was small right up until I left high school. I was still, I weighed less than 105 pounds when I left high school. And I even couldn't wrestle anymore because I was in a 91-pound weight class, I think, in my junior year. So they didn't really have a class then. And the senior year, I just kind of gave up on sports and concentrated on doing the racetrack because by that time I had already made the decision to do so. But for some strange reason, once I left and I started riding on Finger Lakes in 1982, was my first year. Then I grew. I like grew like 4 or 5 inches, and I was like, oh, my God.
No.
So people were looking at me, and they're like, okay, you might, you know, make it a year or two, maybe three. I'll never forget one trainer telling me, let me see your feet. Well, let me see your hands. Mm-hmm. And he says, you got 3 years tops. And when he told me that, he, like, kind of crushed my heart, you know, and all my dreams and stuff. I'm like, oh, my God, why is that guy so callous? And he's telling me like that, you know. So then, you know, then I had to prove him wrong, of course. And I always, to this day, tell him that you remember you told me that. And he's like, oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. So it was just kind of strange how I grew afterwards. I don't know what happened, but I had already made the decision to do it. And I said, nothing's going to stop me. And all I had to do was keep my weight. You know, I didn't really look at myself like I was tall. I just got on the horses and did the best I could, you know, having to, you know, emulate what the normal jockeys look like and ride like. So that's what I did, and that's what I concentrated on.
Well, that hard work and determination paid off, Michael. But tell us how you first arrived at the racetrack and started learning, working on the backside. Tell us what that process was like for you, given that you weren't, again, you weren't really from a family in racing, so I'm sure you didn't have a lot of experience around horses at the time.
Zero experience. I mean, I was, I was delivering papers and caddying at the golf course to make money. I had no idea about the horses, so, I mean, I might have seen a horse once or twice as a kid. That was it. So I was working at a betting advisory service for a horse owner named Richard Bomsey. And I told him I wanted to be a jockey, and he laughed at me. And actually, it was one of his employees, who is now my uncle, who said, hey, can you help my nephew, my future wife's nephew, get onto the racetrack? And he said, yeah, sure. So at the time, Leo O'Brien was his trainer, and I went to work for his brother, Colin O'Brien, and that's how I got on the racetrack at Beaumont Park. And the funny thing is, I was never around horses or any of that outside kind of atmosphere. So I got to the racetrack, and I was cleaning buckets and mucking stalls and doing all that. And I was so allergic. And to this day, I'm still allergic to the horses, like really bad. And the guy says, are you okay? And I'm sneezing. I can't breathe. I mean, my eyes are tearing, everything. It was crazy. But I, again, this is where I had made that decision. And just I was just so determined to do it because I felt like I didn't have any other options, you know. Like you said, I'm not from a horse family. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I didn't know for sure that I didn't want to go to school. So I guess I was just a natural laborer and don't mind doing the work. So that's why I had to say, okay, whatever this is, I'll get over it. And I just kept going and going and going. And finally, my system did get somewhat immune to the horses. I just can't go in the stalls, and too much dust in that kind of upsets me. To this day, but being I work outside and always riding in the fresh air, I think that's what kind of made it work.
That's amazing. I did not know that story. That's pretty crazy. And what was it like for you when you first started galloping horses? I'm sure it took time to get to that point, but did it feel like it came to you pretty naturally?
No, absolutely not. It was the weirdest thing because, like I said, I always did everything by myself, sports-wise, you know, I mean, just very athletic, you know, knew where I was at all times. I mean, could do anything. Then when I got on the horse, now it's like, hey, wait a minute, this is not about me. This is about controlling an animal that has its own mind. So I had no idea about that, absolutely no conception whatsoever. So I was awkward at first, definitely awkward. And so I just started off by riding the horses in the barn, going around the barn. I thought that was the greatest thing in the world. in the beginning, shed rowing the horses, as we call it. And then I graduated up to going up to the pony. There's a little pony track at Belmont Park. It's only like maybe a quarter mile around or something. So then you start there, and then you move up to the, in the wintertime, you get it to go on the training track at Belmont Training Track, and then you get to go to the main track at Belmont Park. So I kind of graduated up to, I'm going to give you a story. We got plenty of time. So the first time the trainer brought me to the main track, he was on. He put me on this one horse, and he was probably too much for me, but for him it wasn't. And the horse ran off with me the wrong way to the racetrack. Now, this is at Belmont Park, mile and a half. It was right after the break, which means everybody, after they harrow the track, all the horses come on at the same time. So that's the busiest time of the morning. Now, we're talking about all the big trainers, Frank Whiteley, Sid Waters Jr. I mean, the list goes on and on. This is 40 years ago, whenever it was. So they were all there watching their horses work. And here I come, I get run off with. The horse makes the gap where he runs out the gap with me, and I go flying, and I spend 8 days in the hospital.
Oh.
So I said to myself at that point, as I'm in the hospital, I said, I'm so mad at myself. I'm never going to let that happen again. So I was very determined to figure it out. And I think that was a turn. That was one of the turning points for me to say, okay, you have to do this. You're going to do it. And that was it. So, and then since that time, I prided myself on being able to gallop a horse. And when I say gallop a horse, meaning, you know, you go out there, the trainer tells you what to do, you do everything that you're supposed to do, and also help the horse as well. So, and I think that's that was what really helped me out a lot, making that determination to say, okay, I'm going to be the best I can be. So,
quite the traumatizing experience there.
Hope that wasn't too long-winded.
No, my gosh. No, Michael. Love those stories. And you know, you mentioned that horrific experience, but that's kind of, by going through that, you knew you were either not going to do it or you're going to determine and decide that you are doing this. And, you know, I told you I went to Chris McCarron's jockey school, and the deciding factor for so many people was when they start to get up to speed, when they start going fast. When we started breezing horses, the number of people who would drop out was pretty large, because some people just don't like that feeling of going that fast. And obviously that wasn't an issue for you.
Especially, yeah, I don't, either that or I was too stupid to realize it.
Well, but
I guess that's what makes us jockeys. I mean, you have the same feeling. You don't have that fear. So, you know, I guess it makes it okay.
I guess so, but eventually you returned to the track after 8 days in the hospital, you said, and you determined to do better and never to let that happen again. So how long did you gallop horses for before you took out your jock's license?
So let's see, I was official in 77, so about 5 years. And again, I wasn't in a hurry. I just felt like I had to wait to make sure that I was right and ready to go. And even when I did go, like, you know, people said, oh, I wasn't ready yet. But there's a time when, even though you might not be 100% ready, you have to go and just take that leap of faith. And I was working for a trainer at the time named Tom Waller, old-time New York bred trainer. And he had an assistant trainer named John Sheringham. And his son named Bruce was a Finger Lakes trainer, and he came back to Belmont Park for the winter time. And he said, why don't you come to Finger Lakes and I'll help you get started, you know, and, you know, kind of guide you a little bit. And I really didn't have any agents. I had zero agents approaching me to be an apprentice jockey in New York. And I really didn't have any other avenues to go. So I said, okay, great. As long as I can go be a jockey, that's a start for me. So I packed my bags and I got on a horse van, and I had $100 in my pocket and a few clothes, and off I went. And that's pretty much how it kind of started for me that way.
And how old were you at the time?
I was 18. I had just graduated high school, and I only had to do that because my mother made me do that. Plus, I probably wouldn't have done that. But I thank her to this day for doing that. And 18, and actually it was really good timing, because my mother was moving to Florida at the time. My parents separated, so she decided to go to Florida, where I am now, actually, because our family started migrating to South Florida. So she said, well, you either come with me or you're on your own. And I said, okay, fine. And that was the summer of 82 or 81, actually, after I graduated high school. And then I spent the summer in Saratoga, and then I came back home. And that winter, I worked at Belmont Park for Mr. Sheringham. And then I left in February of 82 to go be a jockey.
You remember your first race?
Do I remember it?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely. It was a little bit of a weird feeling. It's almost kind of like you're outside of a box looking in. It was really weird. I don't know how to explain it. You know, you're really not even like riding. You're just trying to find your way. And I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. But actually, I take that back. I did do a couple races at the hunt meet in New Jersey. I rode a few races. That didn't even count. The horse was really like traveling like way back last, and it didn't even seem like a real race to me. But the first one I rode at Finger Lakes was like definitely a true race, and it was just a weird feeling. It just didn't feel like anything. And then the second one was a lot better. Now you're in tune. And then I just happened to get lucky, and the third one happened to be my first winner. Mm-hmm. So it happened kind of fast. And again, probably didn't even know it happened, but it just happened. So, and that's how you just, that's what I mean. You take that leap of faith, you know, and you get started and you go.
Did you have any jocks in the room there at Finger Lakes help you out, show you the ropes early on in your career?
Yes, absolutely. I think they all did. It was a wonderful, you know, I look back now and just see what a wonderful group of guys they were. Guys like Leslie Hewlett, Kevin Whitley, Russell Reynolds, Rudy Rincon. I mean, guys that you would never know. John Donahue. I mean, these guys just, they really took me in, so to speak, and they roughed me a few times in a sense where, like, they would yell at me to say, hey, I did this wrong and did that wrong, but they were only trying to help me. And I think, and you as a jockey might be able to answer this as well. You know, we've all been there, and we've all had that feeling of insecurity as a jockey. You don't know what you're doing yet. So to help, and I always feel like I always try to help the young guys, because you don't really know. There's so many, you know, waters that are uncertain that you're coming into, and having somebody guide you a little bit and give you a few pointers, I think it's awesome. And that's what they did for me in Finger Lakes, those jockeys.
Well, and I have to thank you, Michael. You also gave me good advice when I was young in my career as well. And it's also a safety issue too. When you're riding with these young, inexperienced riders, you want to help them out so everyone stays safe and makes it back in one piece, of course. What for you early on came easy, and what did you struggle with?
I think pace was a difficult thing, and that was another thing that I really prided myself on, knowing how fast I was going. I thought that was so important. And to this day, I think it's vital. And at first, I did struggle with it. You know, sometimes you should be going when you should be taking back. You should be taking back when you should be going. And I think every apprentice and or jockey goes through that. So I think that was something that frustrated me. And the part that just came easy, I don't know why, was just being patient with the horses and not rushing them. I just felt like, you know, save something for the end. For whatever reason, it was kind of like drilled into my head when I was, you know, training, you know, with my trainers in New York. I worked for different people, Sidney Waters Jr. and a couple other names I can't remember right now. But, you know, just all along, just knowing that, hey, you got to save something for the finish. And That's what I really, it came easy to me.
Did you have a lot of success during your apprentice year?
Yes, I did well at Finger Lakes. I won about 60 races at Finger Lakes in the short time I was there. And then I left there and I went to Maryland. And I rode at Maryland for the next 6 or 7 months. And unfortunately, I had to run into a kid named Albert Delgado who won the Eclipse Award that year. And another boy, I think his name was Paul McCall. He might have won or was second to him. So I just had a tough year for apprentices. And again, I had to start my whole struggle over again when I got to Maryland because I was so tall. You know, they didn't really like that. I wasn't that stereotype jockey. Even though I was an apprentice, and apprentices are very welcomed in Maryland, even still to this day, I did get a lot of opportunities, but I never really got the, you know, the premier mounts and the premier stables to ride for. But I still did very well, and I actually, that spring of 82, I was the leading apprentice at Pimlico. So if that means anything or not.
Jockey Michael McCarthy is joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Michael, did you find that when you lost your bug, you struggled, like so many do, when you lose that apprentice weight allowance? It can sometimes be tough to make it as a journeyman. Did you find that transition tough?
I most definitely did. As much success as I had at Pimlico when I had my apprenticeship, when I finished, I think I finished there as well with it. And then like 2 weeks later, I got hurt. Mm. And then when I came back in the fall, I started riding a Timonium and a little bit of Laurel. I couldn't get going. The jockey colony was very competitive, and I was doing terrible. So I kind of struggled. And then I think I went to Florida that winter and just took the time off. And I went, and I learned a lot, too. That's when I first started officially working for Alan Jerkins at the winter of 84. And I just kind of, like, had to regroup and say, hey, what am I going to do? And I went back to Finger Lakes where I had, you know, very good success as an apprentice. And I made so many friends, and my agent that I had as an apprentice was available. So I went back to Finger Lakes. And that was in 85. I'm sorry, 84, 85. I don't know exactly. And that's where I kind of started really crafting my jockey business and really trying to be precise and how to get run out of the horses and really how to win. And I did that for a few years, and I really kind of learned, you know, exactly what you're supposed to do. The part I didn't learn so fast was the business aspect of it. That took me a lot longer. But I think at that point, when I got hurt, I just, you know, it's tough. I mean, you've probably seen that as well. You've had a few injuries, and then when you come back, it's not all, you know, roses. They're not all waiting for you. Somebody else is going to step in your shoes and get it done while you're away, so you have to work your way back into it.
Exactly right. It's very tough. And tell our listeners, Michael, what you meant about the business side of things took you a little bit longer to get.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Yeah, tell our listeners what you meant exactly by it took you longer to get the business side of things as a jockey.
Yeah, I think maturity was my biggest hurdle. I was still very immature and had an attitude of where you need me, I don't need you, so to speak. And it took me a while to learn that. And once I figured that out, then my whole attitude, all my business, everything changed. It just changed for the better. And again, I think a majority of it was maturity. And I, you know, when I grew up, I grew up in kind of a weird setting. I didn't get a lot of, parenting that I would like to have gotten. Like we talked earlier with Trevor, I'm glad to see all the success he has at the moment. And I was able to be there for him and help him and guide him. I didn't have any of that. So sometimes, you know, you have to get knocked down before you can kind of learn that, you're not doing the right thing. And that's what I had to struggle with and go through.
How about working in the morning? It's not just obviously about how you perform in the afternoon, but how hard you hustle in the morning. Were you always, I know from when I knew you, you were always such a hard worker in the morning, but were you always like that?
Yeah, you were riding with me at the time, right? I was still riding, correct?
No, we didn't ride together, but I know just from hearing people talk about you and what a hard worker you were in the morning and when you were an agent
Okay, so I think I learned that at Finger Lakes because it's a very funny place. A lot of the jockeys do the riding for the trainers in the morning. They can get anywhere between 10 and 15 horses a day. Well, I don't want to exaggerate, maybe like 7 or 8 to 15 horses in a morning, mm-hmm. almost every morning. So that was customary. That was like if you don't gallop the horses for the trainers, you're not going to ride for them unless you want to make other arrangements. But that's where I kind of, again, for the person that I worked for that brought me up there, Bruce Sheringham, he just was so great with, you know, teaching me, you know, how to get the best out of the horse in the morning and how to make them work properly and use themselves and set them up for races to win. And the nice thing is, as a jockey, you get to see everybody's stable because you're around. You ride for 10, 15, 20 different trainers. Mm-hmm. So you get a piece from this guy. You get a piece from that guy. Everybody has a little bit different method. And I just, like, took that in and really utilized that to my best abilities. And I guess it just kept carrying with me. That's all I knew because that's how I first learned when I went up to Finger Lakes. This is how you got to get them ready. You want to win. You do the right thing in the morning because in the morning, everything simulates. Alan Jerkin says you want to win in the afternoon, you got to simulate in the morning. And he drilled that into my head, and it's oh so true. So I said to myself, well, I want to win. And I don't want anybody else riding these horses in the morning. I'll get on them. I'll do the work. I'll make sure they win because I had to win. So it was a matter of survival. And every chance I had to be the best chance possible. So I just got good at it and things worked for me. And it was trial and error as well. You know, you get on the horses in the morning, you feel them out. And then in the afternoon, you ride them one way. If that don't work, you try another way. And that's basically all it was. I mean, it's very simple. And I guess I just really, I don't know the words I'm trying to say, got that down to a science.
Well, Michael, we're going to take a very short commercial break. Folks, stay with us. You are listening to Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Whoa. Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigle, and I am joined tonight by jockey Michael McCarthy. Michael, before we went to break, you were talking about your hard work ethic, and you were established, you were based at Finger Lakes, and you stayed there for quite a while, actually. And when did you decide to move from Finger Lakes?
I wanted to move like the year I got there, but I couldn't because I had nowhere else to go. But looking back, it was a great learning experience. So I got to the I stayed there really longer than I should have, simply because I met my lovely wife of 30 years, and we had just started a family, and she was like a real home girl. So like to take her out of her element was probably shocking. You know, we got through that, and I just made a decision to say, hey, I need to do something different, and I wound up at Philadelphia Park.
You quickly found success at Philadelphia Park. You were the leading rider there in, I believe, 94 and 95. How long did it take you to just really find success there?
Wow, it was crazy. It was... Yeah, I got there April 16th. I won't forget that because it was tax day, I remember. And I had no money. So that was important. That was an important day because I have to pay the tax man. But if you don't have any money to pay the tax man, then you're thinking, hey, this is an important day.
Right.
So, yeah, I got there, and I just, again, I had to restart my career. I just wasn't getting it at Finger Lakes. And I just felt like I was better than where I was. I wasn't getting opportunities. It was really frustrating for me, and I even contemplated not even being a jockey anymore because it just was so frustrating. You know, I just felt like I wasn't getting enough, you know, business and respect of the business. And I didn't mean that in a bad, like having an attitude way. But just, you know, I just wasn't appreciated, I felt. So then I came to Florida that winter with my wife and two children. I made some contacts. Got an agent, and he was wonderful. We're friends up until now. Ed Fair is his name, and he was a very established agent around Philadelphia Park for years and years. He's from that area, so he had a great name, and he was so helpful. I mean, even, you know, you really need a leg up, so to speak, in any business. So having him be my agent, I felt was such a huge help, because even before I showed up there, nobody even saw me. So, you know, I'm tall. I'm like light years taller than the next guy. So he had me on three or four mounts like the first day. And I'm like, holy geez, she already got me on mounts. This is great. You know, I was just looking to get horses to ride. I figured one here, one there. You got to work your way up. He had me on three or four mounts the first day. And I was like, wow, this is awesome. And I stayed at a friend's house, Steve Rowan. Again, I have no money. I got my wife. It's a long story. We don't have enough time for that story. Two kids. So I had to leave my family in Florida still. And I left to go to Philadelphia Park until I can make some money. And then they'll come up and see me. And we'll all be together again. So Steve Rowan, wonderful trainer, even better friend. He said, you need a place to stay. You can stay on my couch. And literally, I stayed on his couch for about 3-4 months till I got going. He was very, very, very helpful in getting me to get started, have horses to ride. He had about 25 horses at the time. I rode a majority of the horses. So, I mean, gosh, he was another great help. So I think I had a few connections, so to speak, that helped me out in such a way. But having Eddie Fair as my agent was really the main key, because he had so many connections, and he was able to really get me those opportunities that I was looking for. I basically got to Philadelphia Park, and I was only riding for just, you know, the small trainers. I mean, you know, people looked once I got there and they saw me, they were like, oh my God, this guy's so tall. And it's so funny because some of my best friends right now that I made there, they said, when you showed up there, they said, we looked at you and you said, you'll be back at Finger Lakes in 2 months.
Wow.
You know, and it's that negative kind of talk to me that just sets me off and say, I got to prove this guy wrong, you know. And at that time, I had been through a lot of that already. But it was more motivating for me. It was like, okay, you know, I just have to show them what I have, so to speak. And I got such wonderful opportunities, and I wrote for some really cool little stables in the beginning, and the success just came, like you asked me, it just came instantaneous. I mean, I don't know, you know, when you start going and you start winning, the horses just run for you. I was winning with horses were 50-1, 30-1, 20-1, like crazy horses that you just say to yourself, how did that horse win, you know? And my agent was telling me, he says, what are you doing? He says, how do you make these horses come from back in the pack? It looks like you have no chance. And then all of a sudden, the horses are flying. It was just, and again, it just takes me back to, you know, the days at Finger Lakes. I just started crafting and really working on how to get horses to run. And, you know, I know they only have a short run. You got to save it for that period of time. And it just started working, and it was. It was just instant success, and it was crazy. It was crazy good, though.
Talking about those long shots, Michael, in 95, you won your first graded stake, the Grade 3 Cherry Hill Mile Stakes. Paid $66 that day with San Francisco for Guadalupe Preciado, a well-known trader there.
Wow, that was a good stat. You pulled out a good stat there. I forgot about that one.
Yes, sir. And tell us about that moment, your first graded stakes victory. That had to be a long shot as well. Had to be an incredible feeling.
Yeah, beating a guy like Rick Wilson, who was a tremendous jockey. He won about 5,000 races. I mean, that guy was awesome. And I remember the guy, the trainer, Ned Allard, he was so mad. He said, who is that guy? I've been watching him at Philadelphia Park. Who is he? You know, and because he was a New Jersey trainer. He was based at Garden State, which is across the river there. And I didn't ride for him or anything. And he was so upset he lost the race because he had, like, one of the favorites. But it was great. I mean, again, Lupe Preciado, another guy who just, oh, my God, I had so much success for that guy. And his owner, Jack Mondell, rode me on all his horses. And, I mean, it was just incredible. I don't know. I don't know how to say it. I worked really hard, and the people saw that I worked hard. I worked harder than all the jockeys there. They were all mad at me because I'd get on all the horses in the morning, and they were like, oh, you're making us look bad and, you know, that kind of stuff. And it's funny. I laugh now, you know, but I don't know. It's just, I guess it, you know, you go through things in life, and at one point you keep trying and doing the right thing, and it all comes together. And that night to win the Cherry Hill Mile was just an amazing night for me. It was like you said, my first graded win. And as a kid, you know, I saw horses like, oh, man, I forgot his name just now, win the Cherry Hill Mile. And, you know, the good horses won that race. I mean, really good horses. Spendabuck, I think he won the Cherry Hill Mile, maybe one of those races. And, like, Stepping Stones to the Derby and stuff like that. I mean, just it was a big race for me to win. So I was very excited after that race.
And especially given the fact that you mentioned the struggling time you experienced leaving Finger Lakes, and you weren't even sure if you wanted to keep riding. And then couple years later, you win your first graded stake victory. That had to be an amazing, amazing feeling. And you talk about how hard you worked. We mentioned this a little bit earlier. You're 5'9.5" tall. I thought I was tall. I'm 5'6". You're even taller. So something you had to work on even harder than the others was on your weight. And tell us how you were able to keep your weight light enough.
Oh, that was so easy. Just don't eat.
I mean, I guess it makes sense, right?
It's a lot harder said than done, of course. But I don't know. I remember eating, like, when I first started in Finger Lakes, I would eat a can of tuna fish and then go to bed. Like, literally say, okay, that's it. That's all I can eat. But I don't know. You know, you work and you're determined and you block all that other stuff out. And like I spoke earlier, you do what you have to do. If that's what it takes to do it, you do it. So, like, sometimes I get a little frustrated, like, where these guys go, oh, the weights, we got to raise the weights. It's like Wayne Lucas put it, you know, as callous as he was when he said it, if you can't fit the stereotype of being a jockey, then don't be a jockey.
Right.
So that, to me, is how I set my standards. Hey, if I don't meet the criteria, I can't do this. So whatever I have to do, I have to meet the criteria. And And that's really what I did. I just really watched myself. And to this day, I'm so nutritionally aware of foods to eat and how your body works. I think being in tune with your body and knowing how your body reacts to the foods you take in, it's everything. Because if you don't have that knowledge, it's not going to work for you.
Were you tempted at all? Obviously, there are certain ways some jockeys keep their weight down that are extremely unhealthy. Were you tempted by any of those, or you were just that disciplined that you didn't have to resort to those methods?
No, come on. Every kid tries everything. So I tried Lasix. That failed on me. I rode a horse at Laurel. Like, I was off for 2 weeks between Laurel and Finger Lakes with my apprenticeship. And all the guys in the room were using all the pills and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, try to keep it as natural as possible. But then when you take this Lasix, it just makes you pee everything out. So it was great. So I was like, oh, man, this is like the pill from heaven. But I had 2 weeks off, and I rode my first race back at Laurel. It was a mile underneath. So I go, and I take the Lasix pill, and it doesn't work. It's like, okay, why am I not peeing? I'm like, oh, man, now it's getting close to the post time. I'm like, holy cow, I better go in the sweatbox because I got to make weight. So you told everybody I'm 5'9 and a half. I was tacking 107 as an apprentice. So that meant I had to weigh 104 and a half because the saddle and your clothes was about 3.5 pounds. So now I'm somewhere around 6, and I'm like, have to lose a couple pounds. I'm like, oh, my God, you know, this Lasix pill isn't working. What am I going to do? So now I have to go in the steam room. And I'm in there, and then I start peeing and sweating at the same time, and then it was like, okay, good, I got my weight off. And I didn't feel bad at the time. I went out, I rode the race, mile and an eighth. I came back, I'm like, okay, no, I don't feel good. I'm coming back, galloping the horse back to the unsaddling area, and I'm like, okay, I feel like really lightheaded. So I, you know, how jockeys dismount off their horse, a little kind of jump off. Well, I did one of them, and I almost fell down. Like, I almost fell backwards, and I grabbed the saddle to keep me from falling down. And I made it to the scale just barely. And then you rode at Laurel, so you know that long walk back from Laurel Park, right, back to the jockey's room. It's a long way.
Right.
And thank God we were in the – there's a tunnel. At the time, they used the tunnel in the wintertime because it was kind of nasty, so the guys would – go under the tunnel and come out by the paddock. And I barely made it back to my bench at the jockey's room because it dehydrated me so bad. I started cramping, and it was horrible. And that was the last time I ever used Lasix. So that was one of the things I experimented with. Then you experiment with laxatives, same thing, dehydrate you. That didn't last long. And then sometimes guys, you know, make themselves throw up, and I did do that for most of my career, but I was very controlled when I did it, so I only did it at certain times. So there'll be times when you go out to dinner and you don't want to look foolish, like you're starving yourself, maybe something like that, and or in the jockey's room, if you're sitting in the sweat box and you're really hot, you might want to sip on some soda or an ice pop or something, but you can't keep it in you because it's water going back in you. So then I would, you know, sometimes throw them back up. Sounds kind of harsh, but basically that was it. I just knew it was a matter of you go in a sweat box, you sweat it out, and we call it reducing for a reason because you're only taking the water weight out of your body for 5 or 6 hours during that afternoon that you're riding for. And that was really it. It was about eating healthy and sweating, and that was it. I mean, again, it's really simple. It's about your diet. So those are some of the things I had to do.
Jockey Michael McCarthy is joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Michael, time is just flying by. We have a lot still left to discuss. Eventually, you decided to go to Delaware Park, which is where you found so much success. And from what I understand, having done my research, you and your agent decided to do that because of the slot machine money. Purses were so great. And similar question I'm going to ask you about Delaware. Did you find immediate success once you moved your tack there?
Actually, I you know, when you're at Philadelphia Park, you know, you're going to be at Philadelphia Park for a long time if you don't decide, hey, I need to go to the next level. So being the leading jockey there for the first 2 years that I was there, I felt like, okay, I want to keep going. This is a great part of my life. I'm maybe like 30 years old. And I said, you know, this is like either do or die. So if I want to get better, if I want to ride better horses and, you know, maybe make some more money for my family, then I need to go to the next level. So the obvious next level would be to go to New Jersey, because that was kind of the next level up. Because Philadelphia Park was considered a little bit lower than a mammoth park, so to speak. It was still equivalent to like Atlantic City / Garden State, but Monmouth was where, you know, you're going to get the big trainers coming from Belmont and stuff like that with their second string of horses. So it's kind of the next level. So I decided I'm going to go to Monmouth. And my agent said, okay, I'll go to Monmouth with you as well. And I even looked at a house and I put a deposit on the house at Monmouth. And then he said, you know what, Mike, we should really consider going to Delaware. He said, because one of the big trainers that I was riding for at Philadelphia Park, his name is Bob Kamak, he had just decided to go to Delaware. And that was before I made my decision to go to Monmouth. So when he said that to me, he said, you know, Bob Kamak's going to go to Delaware. I think it would be a good idea to go there. They're going to get the slots. You know, the purse money isn't too bad at first. And I said, okay, you know, I thought about it. And I said, you know what, if you know, and I went and talked to Mr. Kamak, and he said, no. He says, you come to Delaware, he says, and I'll support you. And I said, okay, great. It's just what I want to hear. So I got my money back from my house, deposit I put down on the house at Monmouth, and I told my wife we're going to go to Delaware. So in the first year we went to Delaware was 96. And I still lived in Philadelphia, around Philadelphia Park, and I was just commuting back and forth until I found that I could, you know, be successful there. And then I chose to get a house, and we moved in a house. And I think it was in August, July or August of that year of 96. And I had made that commitment to say, okay, now we're gonna stay in right here at Delaware.
And were you leading rider at Delaware that first year?
I was. It was crazy. We did really good. And kind of a fun time. We didn't know a lot of people there. There were people from all over. They would come from Florida. They came from Ohio. They came from all different places. Kentucky, that first year, a lot of people from Jersey, a lot of Jersey trainers came, and also Philadelphia Park trainers came. Now, that was the biggest thing the first 2 years I was there that made me win a lot of races, because all the success I had at Philadelphia, where the purses weren't as good as Delaware, a lot of those trainers brought their horses to Delaware. And who were they looking for? They were looking for me, because they knew me. I rode for them. I won for them. It was awesome. I mean, I made such great contacts having those people from Philadelphia Park, and it just worked out so well. I mean, it was just everything worked out. It was, I don't know why.
Definitely worked out, Michael. I'll reiterate, you were six-time leading rider there at Delaware Park. You won six races in a single day there twice, not once, but twice, and just found so much success there. We only have 10 minutes left, so I would love to cover it in more detail, but you made the right move by going to Delaware Park, that's for sure. And interesting fact, actually, Trevor almost broke your record at Delaware Park by, what did he win, five races in a single day there, I believe?
Yeah, he won five, and we were rooting, his mother and I, we were rooting for him. I said, come on, I hope you can beat me, if not, tie me. So I think he only won five that day, but he had such an awesome day, and he had a couple chances to do it, too. And, I mean, just to have his name next to mine would have been super cool. It would have been even better if his name was above mine, but He could maybe still do that one day. Who knows?
Definitely. Definitely. Now, I want to ask you, when Trevor decided that he wanted to be a jockey and he came up to you and he said that, what was your response?
I think the first time he didn't actually come and ask me, ask us, but I think the first time we really knew, he was about four, maybe five, and we're all sitting at the dinner table, my family. And he said to me, like, everybody's kind of quiet, and he looks up and he goes, hey, Dad, he says, what does it feel like to be in the starting gate? And we all just, and I mean, he's really young. I mean, like I said, 4 or 5 tops. And I said, oh. I said, why do you want to know that? He goes, I don't know. I don't know, he said. And I said, okay, it feels really cool. And then when the gates open, the horse takes off and goes fast. But that was the moment that my wife and I just looked at each other and was like, wow, where did that come from? and that's when we knew that this kid's hooked. And he was at the my hip every moment possible with the horses. And then when I started training horses, when I retired, he was at the barn with me, I mean, every single day off. I mean, he was there just constantly. That's all he wanted to do. It's amazing.
Did you have any reservations about it?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, my wife comes from kind of a horsey background, too. She did, you know, showing the horses and all that kind of stuff. And she knows what it is. I mean, when you have that feeling and that's what you want to do, why stop it, you know? And that's how we felt. And then the better thing to that is I was able to help him. I mean, that's what really, as a parent, makes you just feel so great that you're able to help him. And I thank everybody that, you know, helps Trevor and has helped him along the way. So it's been great to see him doing well.
When you were retired at the time when he first decided to start riding, so, Michael, when did you come to that decision to retire?
It was really amazing timing for him. I mean, for me to then turn trainer. Now I had the horses to train him. It was amazing. I mean, the timing couldn't have been any better. Even though I did turn him over to Grand Motion when I decided I didn't want to train the horses anymore, that was great timing, too, because I was just kind of getting frustrated as a trainer, so to speak, and it's a lot of work and all that. And Trevor was ready then, so I trained for about 5 or 6 years. And in that time, I started getting Trevor to start gallop the horses and teach him everything and all that. And I just decided, it was 2002, I retired. But literally my body was telling me like 2 years before that. So like my period of getting to the end of the Delaware season. And I liked Delaware too because it was an 8-month out of the year meet. So they closed for the winter. So, I mean, it was awesome. You know, I still got my breaks, and I think that's why I lasted a long time too. I rode for 21 years, and I think the reason I did last that long is because I always took some months off in the wintertime. And that's what was great about Delaware. I wasn't losing any business. Everybody scattered and went everywhere for the winter. Then when they reopened in April, they were all together again, and that was all my business. So it just worked out really well for me. But it just, my body just gave out, and I knew a few years before, and little by little, I was just like, okay, I can't do this anymore. And I was doing so good. It was really sad for me because I was really doing so awesome, and I had to give it up because it was that bad. I mean, I was really having a hard time. The fatigue was setting in, and he was just telling me. So I was like, okay, you know, I love the horses, and I'll train horses and see how that works. And, you know, financially I was doing pretty well, so I was able to do that.
When you mentioned you trained horses for several years, and I know you were an agent for a while as well, but tell our audience what you're doing now.
Yeah, the agent thing didn't work out. It takes a special person. You got to have a really good memory and all that kind of stuff. That was a little frustrating, too. But now I'm in business doing property management here in Florida, something different. It has its pros and cons, but, you know, the nice thing is I get weekends and holidays, and, you know, I work at my own pace, which is really kind of cool. And it's something different. It keeps my brain going. Which needs a lot of activity at all times. And it's going well, though. It really is. It's good. I still do some riding on the side as well. I do some equestrian riding now to kind of keep in with the horses, and that's a lot of fun. So, and then I kind of still stay with the horses just watching my son ride, which is quite enjoyable.
You mentioned the equestrian riding you're doing now, Michael. When we talked on the phone first discussing having you on the show, you went into detail about you're helping these retired thoroughbreds, off-the-track thoroughbreds, find new careers as well. And I think that's just a great thing that you do.
Yeah, it's really awesome. I mean, I'm not in any group or any, but I do know that when we did this benefit riding event called the Real Riders Cup last September of 2017, Anita Motion, Graham Motion's wife, put the whole thing together just to showcase retired and, how do I want to say, you know, recycled thoroughbred racehorses to have other, you know, another career or another life after thoroughbred racing, you know. So that event was just amazing, and to be a part of that is just great, because the horses are my whole life, and, you know, they made the life that I have today. So anything I could do to help them is just awesome for me. I mean, it makes me feel good to give back.
You get that same type of thrill, Michael, riding these horses now, maybe taking one over a jump. Do you still get that rush?
I don't know. It's not as thrilling. It is a rush, though. It is very exciting. I just wish I was better at it. Then I would maybe enjoy it a little bit more. But that'll come in time. You know, I still have a lot to learn. It's an entirely different way of doing things in the equestrian world and in eventing and showing. And actually, it's very mindful as far as instruction is concerned. You have to instruct the horse to do so many things and to carry themselves in so many ways. And it's a lot for both the horse and the rider. But when you do it right, it's a great feeling.
What a great thing you do. Like you said, giving back to these animals that gave you so much. We only have just a couple minutes, actually 1 minute left here, Michael. I'm going to ask you one last question. You won multiple graded stakes. Who was the nicest horse you rode?
I don't even look at horses like that. And I don't want to say it, because I rode horses at Finger Lakes that had broken knees and broken ankles and just, you know, such deficiencies in taking away some of their true abilities. And the heart and the determination that those things had, to me, I mean, I never forget those first few years that I rode at Finger Lakes and some of the, you know, the better horses I rode at Finger Lakes. To me, it was those knock-around, they call them knock-around claimers. Even the ones I rode around Delaware and had some really, really talented horses that, you know, they were running for 7,500 claiming and just knocking them dead. And just week after week, they just keep coming back. To me, those are the horses that I admire even more than riding horses that are graded stake winners.
Michael, we are...
I mean that seriously when I say that. Seriously.
We are all out of time, Michael, but it has been such a fun hour spending with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was very enjoyable, like you said, and I just want to encourage the horse racing fans to keep watching and keep rooting. Thank you very much for having me.
Wishing Michael McCarthy all the best. Folks, you can check out this show and replays of all of our other shows on the website, horseracingradio.net. And be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Dalapina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.